Susan Blackmore is a visiting professor at the University of Plymouth. She is a distinguished writer within the area of consciousness, and she is the author of Conversations on Consciousness.
Does the brain produce the mind? And if so, how and what evidence is there for this, Sue?
Sure, that's three questions in one, isn't it? The first question, does it produce the mind? No. A second one, well, since the first one's no, I don't have to answer it. I'll leave the third one for now. I would say the brain doesn't produce the mind because that just gets you straight into dualism. And dualism can't work for so many reasons, not least because if there really were two totally separate kinds of things, they couldn't communicate with each other. So we wouldn't be able to explain things like why drugs that affect the brain change our state of consciousness or anything like that. So if you say the brain produces the mind, you've got a problem. Of course, many, many scientists do say that. And the whole of the hard problem arises for that. Dave Chalmers, in his original formulation of the hard problem, said that this is the question of how an objective brain gives rise to subjective experiences. Well, gives rise to is similar to produce, and you've got the same problem. Now, Dave Chalmers is a kind of dualist, but he's pretty rare there. And I think the real problem is that so many scientists really think about consciousness as something that is produced by the brain and don't realize what a nightmare that leads you into.
You've gone an extra level beyond this material because you're basically saying the two are exactly the same, and even kind of separating them, this dichotomy that the brain produces the mind, is already a problem. So on the one hand, that's a good reason to completely reject any form of dualism and the hard problem that follows from that, because it's not even valid. So I'm assuming this would go into the realm of someone like Daniel Dennett, who rejects the Cartesian theatre. There is no mind, no specialness going on there. You literally are your brain. Okay, that's a valid view. Many people hold that. We can do away, from your perspective, with the problem of the hard problem and this duality. How does this then lead us with the problem of qualia?
You've leapt way, way, way ahead of where I went. Let me go back a step. So I would say that the hard problem, as it is normally stated, implies a kind of dualism that I can't accept. I think it's rubbish and that's going to lead you into trouble. That doesn't mean I know where we go from there. I mean, you've taken it into something like identity theory, that the brain just is the mind, or that really we're talking about consciousness, though. Not, I mean, the mind I think encompasses an awful lot more. We're talking about subjective experience. I cannot see how the firing of neurons in the brain can be my experience of, well, I'm looking at a kind of bluish screen at the moment. You know, it's a really wonderful blue and it kind of fades darker in the middle and paler at the outside. You know, this is my ineffable private personal experience. Call it a quale if you like, although in brackets there are problems with that too. But here is this extraordinary experience. It seems to be me experiencing this blue color on this screen. How can that be the firing of neurons? Maybe it is. I had a wonderful conversation with both the Churchlands, Pat and Paul, some years ago. It's in my book, Conversations on Consciousness. Yeah. And Pat said, you know, centuries ago, people would have just not understood if you said that light just is electromagnetic radiation, because it wouldn't make any sense. They wouldn't be able to get their heads around it at all. Well, maybe in, 10 years or 20 years or something, people will say the same about consciousness and the firing of neurons. It will be obvious to them why they're the same thing, but it isn't obvious to me now. So I don't leap straight from saying the hard problem is misconceived into identity theory. I'm left floundering in the mystery.
Okay, that's reasonable, but you're still making the assumption, because on the one hand, if you're saying that you don't know why the brain produces a whole host of conscious experience on the one hand, yet you're clearly rejecting dualism on the other, isn't that counting your chickens before you've gotten there, so to speak?
Well, it might be, but actually what I am tending to do at the moment And after all, I've been struggling with this one way or another for a long time. What I'm tending to do at the moment is to take an idea that comes more directly out of my own anomalous, strange experiences, my decades long of Zen meditation, as well as science and philosophy. And it's something like this. Whenever we ask ourselves, am I conscious now? The answer always is yes. Somehow just asking that brings up a self who's having an experience, and I say that I'm conscious now of this blue screen in front of me. But hang on a minute. A moment before that, was I conscious of, I was still, you know, staring ahead of me at this blue screen. But actually, it felt like I became conscious when I asked myself that question. So what was happening before? I don't know. Now, I suspect that something like this is going on. Whenever we ask ourselves about qualia, about who am I, about the nature of consciousness or whatever, that questioning itself changes the state we're in and causes the brain to produce a self, an experience, and so on, and us to call it, as an attribution, that's what I'm conscious of now. But most of the time, when we're walking around in our ordinary life, getting on with stuff, there's multiple parallel things going on in our head, loads and loads of them. We can see them in scanners, you know, lots and lots of different things going on. And if you ask which one was I conscious of at any particular time, there isn't any answer. As long as I wasn't asking myself what I'm conscious of, there's no answer. As Dennett would put it, in a slightly different theory than mine, but it's related, he would say there is no fact of the matter. And I think he's absolutely spot on there. 99%, unless you are really practicing mindfulness all the time, or in some way going around asking yourself, am I conscious now? Who am I? Blah, blah, blah. Unless you're doing that, there are multiple parallel things going on, and there is no sense in which you are conscious of one and not the others.
Sure, no, that's a very interesting point. So essentially, just to summarise aspects of that, most of the time we walk around on autopilot, just problem-solving beings that aren't necessarily aware that we are, on the other hand, experiencing this conscious experience until we actually ask, oh, why am I conscious? Why am I doing this? And then that comes into play. How does this pan out in the, for example, the dream state in which you can be conscious in a dream and still experience yourself in a dream, but it's not your conscious self, if that makes any sense?
You're leaping ahead of me again here, because you're saying it's on autopilot, and I'm not really saying that. I mean, the idea of autopilot is, I think in ordinary parlance, is something like, you know, I'm conscious some of the time and then I go off into autopilot. I'm saying that you're conscious none of the time. It's just an after the fact attribution. And well, at those moments when you're asking, "Am I conscious now?" then you're making a decision. I'm going to say I'm conscious of this. But most of the time, it's always after the fact attributions. You know, think, well, I did this, I chose that, I decided to do that, I picked up this, I drank that coffee, I must have been conscious of it. And I'm saying, no, it isn't like that. Consciousness is not something like that. Consciousness is not something like, oh, there are some conscious processes and some not. There are sometimes I'm conscious and sometimes I'm not. It's an attribution that we make. And we make a false attribution, if you like, because we think it's something that arises from or emerges from or is produced by the brain. And actually, it's just a name we give to certain processes and not others. When there are brain processes involving a self that are constructed in a certain way. I mean, I don't know. We could find the neural correlates of what it is that makes those attributions. But in my opinion, we will never find the neural correlates of consciousness itself, because there isn't any such thing. So now I can come to your question about dreaming. So our normal, ordinary dreams, then during the dream, as you would expect, there's just stuff happening, loads and loads of weird stuff happening. And then we wake up and we go, oh, I remember that. And, oh, I've been dreaming. And, you know, construct some plausible kind of story out of all the stuff that was going on. And we know a lot about dreaming. We know it happens it roughly in real time, and there are things going on. We can look at dreaming brains and see them going on. But again, I would say there is no sense in which any of those things going on are conscious and some are not conscious, because that doesn't mean anything, in my opinion. So now you come to a lucid dream in which you know during the dream that it's a dream. Well, that, to my mind, is very much like the special times I was talking about, when you kind of ask yourself, what am I conscious of? That's the weird thing in a lucid dream. It's, I mean, they're wonderful dreams. I rarely have them, but I love them when I do have them. And you go, oh, hang on a minute. is this a dream? Wow. And then you're in that moment thinking, gosh, I'm, you know, and then after a moment or two, typically for most people, you wander off and forget it all again, and you're off back into ordinary dreaming.
So it's not exactly autopilot at all, as you cleared up there. It's just experiencing pure consciousness per se, whether you're awake or dreaming, and it's not till you step back and have a moment, oh, I'm conscious here, that comes into play.
Yes. But the real crux of what I'm saying, and this is exactly now very, very similar to what Dennett is saying, is if we think there are some processes that are conscious and some that are not of the things going on in the brain, we're wrong. We're deluded. That's the way we think about consciousness. That's how most scientists think about consciousness, mm-hmm. that some of our brain processes are conscious and some aren't, that somehow this consciousness that attaches itself or whatever to some neurons and not others, and then consciousness emerges. All that is wrong. We should not think about consciousness that way at all. It isn't that kind of thing. If you do think about it that way, you get right into the explanatory gap, the hard problem, the mind-body mm-hmm. problem, all of those difficulties. And they are, I would say, insoluble, because they're asking the wrong question. They're asking this question, how does subjective experience emerge from, arise from a physical objective brain? Well, it doesn't. That's the wrong way of thinking about it, in my opinion.
We won't get into the philosophical problems faced by all scientists alike in terms of, obviously, the phenomena you're trying to explain depends on how you're defining it. So obviously that definition would leave out other inputs, so to speak. But with this kind of area in the, well, when we define consciousness or the way you've defined it, apart from that aside, in neuroscience, so for example, like you were saying, a lot of this is how do these firings here in a neuron produce this conscious state? We can't actually say produce this conscious state for many reasons. How do you feel about the assertion, without getting into the philosophical underpinnings of what constitutes causation, the charge that's often levied to neuroscientists, the wide practice of it, that all they produce is correlations?
Well, it's very important in any science to know when you're just finding correlations and when you are really able to look at causes. But I think that question is only really relevant if you take the standard idea of consciousness as being something in itself, something different from the functions or the processes in the brain or whatever else is going on. And I don't. You know, I think the whole thing about the whole hunt for the neural correlates of consciousness is misguided. Mm-hmm. Now, I must clarify this, because I think what's actually happening is, when people are looking for that, is they're doing really well at finding the neural correlates of particular content, if you like to call it that. I don't like the idea that consciousness is not a container, so but I don't know what other word to use. You know, we now know a lot about what neurons have to be firing to make that particular green that I'm looking at, or what neurons need to be firing for the feel of me holding this microphone here. Mm-hmm. Scratching my head and the noise I can hear when I do it. We're learning more and more and more about what is happening in the brain when particular things are experienced. And that's fine. Where I'm arguing is that we're not going to ever be able to find that some of those things are in consciousness and some of them are not, because that is part of the big mistake that most scientists are making. I'm absolutely with Dan Dennett when he says that most of the scientists working on consciousness are Cartesian materialists. What he means by that is that they say they're materialists, but they still believe in part of the Cartesian, Descartes' vision, which is the idea that there is a kind of finishing line, and when things get over the finish, when any neural process gets over some, you know, some threshold or some finishing line, it becomes conscious, or it gets to where I am in my little Cartesian theatre inside the mind somewhere, watching the things that go on there. All this is nonsense, he says, and yet that is the underlying picture that most scientists have in their head of what consciousness must be. Things come into consciousness and go out again, or on there, on the fringes, if you like, and they become conscious and then cease to be conscious. All this is, in both Dan's view and mine, totally the wrong way of thinking about it.
Okay, no, that's all valid points. Still, there must be an aspect there of self-enclosed circularity in the argument. Therefore, for example, we don't need to discuss whether these issues are about correlations, because if we discuss about correlations, we're assuming that the mind is this kind of still materialist Cartesian dualist that's separate from the brain, as where your approach there and another ultra eliminative materialist approach from Dennett would say, we don't even need to talk about correlations here, and let's just dismiss that, because clearly they are completely the same. It's still an assumption in the other area, but the points you make within that definitional framework are valid, and it's obviously true that we should perhaps start to think about consciousness in other ways.
Yeah, and that's really, really, really difficult. That's why I spend quite a lot of time meditating and kind of asking, you know, like a koan in Zen practice, what is this? It's a very well-known koan, is what is this? In fact, it's the only koan used in Korean Zen, which is not the tradition I have trained in, but it's used in many traditions. What is this? Well, what is this to start with? It's this, whatever is arising at the moment. And in a way, that is the only question you need if you want to ask directly in your own experience about consciousness. And a lot of what I'm saying has come from simply sitting still with a quiet mind and then letting that question pop in. I mean, it could be, what am I conscious of? Or what was I conscious of a moment ago? Or lots of other questions, but what is this will do. And there is the mystery. I mean, if you really calm the mind and stare at whatever's happening and hear whatever's happening utterly mindfully, there is the mystery right on. What? What is this?
No, it's when you think of it like that, it's actually both quite mysterious and profound in that respect.
Yeah, it is mysterious and profound. I mean, you know, we started at the beginning and you said, oh, well, if you reject the hard problem, then you conclude blah, 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 blah. I really don't have any strong, firm place to stand or conclusions. I can wipe away a lot of things and I can make some suggestions. But really, profound and mysterious is how the problem looks to me at the moment, which suggests that we are making big mistakes in the way we think about it, and we have to overturn our normal way of thinking about it, which is why I go to meditation sometimes, which is coming at it from such a very different point of view.
Well, your experiments per se of actually sitting there and meditating practically probably wouldn't be the best time-efficient experiment in a neuroscience lab, but it's a good way to take that on. Why can't something remain mysterious? There's nothing wrong with that. Obviously, it leaves gaps arguments for spiritualists or God types, but sometimes shouldn't we just face the fact that some stuff's just mysterious? Yes?
Yes, except that human nature, at least for a lot of us, and certainly for you, or you wouldn't be doing this podcast, would you, is to see a mystery and go, wow, that's really mysterious. I want to delve into this mystery. Now, I think some people want always to solve a mystery, in other words, to really get a firm answer to it. Others, and I think I'm one of these, enjoys the mystery, clarifying it, going into it, because the more you go into a real mystery, then you might sort of solve a little bit and help you, and then something becomes clearer, and then you get, you know, more mysteries open up. The same as in scientific investigation, it's always said the more you find out, the more you find out you don't know. And so playing in mystery is fine. I certainly don't want to do what you said. I'm not sure if you really meant that, but, you know, oh, wow, there's a mystery. I'll just leave it mysterious. That's not really human nature, is it?
No, I agree with that. But you've always got to face the possibility that you might just never know.
Yeah. I'm quite used to not knowing. Not knowing is painful. And being wrong is painful. And those are pains that I've got used to in my life, and lots of other people have too. I think there are a lot of skills involved in playing with mystery, and that involves persistence, enthusiasm, not being too frightened of being wrong, not being too frightened of changing your ideas when something shows that you're wrong. And not being frightened of the thought that you might never, ever, ever get any further than where you are now. When you put it all like that, it sounds like, why would anyone do it? And I wonder that myself. But I do. I just am that kind of person.
when you put it like that, why does anyone get out of bed in the morning at all when you put it like that? But obviously you're going to at least fulfill your day with enjoying these activities, even though you might be wrong, you still need to get more information, or you might never ever know, but it's still fulfilling for certain aspects of the day. I'm assuming most people that do any kind of research in general would agree on those certain parameters, or else why do anything at all? Now, Sue, I know you've talked fondly already, and I know from your writings and books that of yours that I've read and the lectures that you've given that you're big into meditation. I know you were once big into parapsychology and ESP. I believe nowadays you spent a lot of your time investigating that and then also kind of debunking that and throwing that away from it. We can talk about that at the end if you wish, but that's a separate issue. But what I want to do now is, when we've talked about how elusive consciousness is to primarily define or research and come up with some causal explanations for it, we're always going to have problematic endeavours. With this in mind, one of the most controversial areas in this field over time, and I think you put it quite eloquently in Conversations on Consciousness, was mystery mongering, and this was aimed at Stuart Hameroff, who lately, in collaboration over the last few years with Roger Penrose's The Quantum Version of Consciousness. In your conversation with him, you're obviously very open-minded and frank, obviously, as the interviewer. I personally want to get your thoughts on that, how that currently stands. It's obviously massively, massively denied and not taken seriously by a lot of people. What do you think of its validity and the research that Hameroff has put forward with Penrose? The problem is you've got a mathematician and someone that specialises in quantum mechanics speaking to the guy who, and a professor in university, to research consciousness. Is that a further problem in terms of blurring what they're actually trying to investigate in the first place? How do you feel about all this, Sue?
Oh, well, that's just one of the many, many, many problems. On the positive side, at least in some versions of Hameroff and Penrose's theory, it is testable. And therefore, really, the simplest thing I can say is maybe they're right. Let them do the experiments. And if they're right, then they'll make valid predictions and I'll be shown to be wrong. That's how science works. I think the chances of that happening are absolutely minuscule, because I think it's basically rubbish. If you think about the real problem of consciousness, about the nature of subjectivity, take it in terms of the hard problem, if you like. What on earth does the quantum theory of consciousness have to contribute to understanding subjectivity? Now, they will say something like, oh, well, our experience is unified, and if we look at various quantum effects, they unify things in the brain. Well, is our experience unified? There's an awful lot of evidence that suggests that it's not, and that the unification of self that we believe in is actually one of these after-the-fact attributions. We just assume it's the same self now as the one that started this conversation half an hour ago. It's not. It's just another process thrown up, and another ephemeral one. Or the unity of consciousness at one time, I think that's illusory as well. They say various other things about how a quantum theory might relate to subjective experience. But it leaves an explanatory gap, put it the way they do, and it leaves the hard problem or the explanatory gap intact. That they, by saying that consciousness emerges from quantum coherence in the microtubules, I don't think it in any way addresses the real problems of subjectivity. That is just one of many reasons why I don't think it helps at all. And what's particularly frustrating, of course, is that lots of people really love it for many different reasons. One of those reasons, a particularly bad one, is that people seem to think, a few people seem to think that scientists are in some way denying the importance of consciousness. They're denying its quantum basis. If only they would open their minds and see that it's all, I don't know, on another plane, and all sorts of stuff gets tagged onto that. And I find that rather frustrating. But as I said, if they're right, if they can make testable predictions, that's fine.
A lot of that ties into what you're saying. Obviously, it was the problem of how we're defining consciousness. I personally, from my experience of consciousness, I don't believe that there's a unified I that I experience, even when I'm conscious, like right now when I'm talking, there's different processes going on there. A unified self in you, I think a lot of people, it's a very easy argument to make, and it's quite clearly aspect of it must surely be true that people perhaps don't take on board as much as they should. For example, the drunk Sue or the drunk Tony is not the sober Sue, is not the sober Tony. Okay, you might say they're quite literally not the same person in terms of what you're thinking, what you're talking, etc., which is an issue where I think there is no unified experience ever. The problem with Hameroff and Penrose, like you alluded to, many, many other people agree that it's basically just absolute nonsense, and an aspect of it is how they're defining consciousness. Of course, it's been hijacked to a certain extent by the New Age movement and other movements. For some reason, a lot of people try to throw in the soul in there. It also looks like Roger Penrose has basically done some work on quantum mechanics, read a bit on consciousness, and was like, oh, this is mysterious, might be this might help. It's very up in the air. Thanks for your perspective on it. With this kind of stuff in mind, leaving that to the side, if we could talk about ESP, parapsychology, I know you were interested in it. How do you feel, I'm assuming that you know the work of Dean Radin and the Noetics Institute in America and Rupert Sheldrake here. The main argument I see in some of these wars is where pro-ESP, pro-parapsychology researchers are like, oh no, we've got statistically significant research that can back this up, and the wider community is, no, we haven't. How do you feel on that? And is that just another nonsense approach to studying psychology, cognition, and eventually the mind?
Well, it's very tricky indeed. You're right, I did a lot of work in parapsychology over many years, starting with an extraordinary experience that I had that convinced me of the reality of telepathy, clairvoyance, psychokinesis, precognition, other worlds, souls, spirits, astral planes, and a whole lot of stuff. So I was starting out at the age of 18, 19, believing in all of those things. And I trained as a tarot reader and became reasonably good at tarot reading. I used to, well, I've still got my crystal ball. I can see it from where I'm sitting. I learned scrying. I trained as a witch and belonged to a coven for a while. I did all kinds of stuff like this. I went to lots of mediumistic circles and learned a lot about communication with the dead. But all of this, all the time, because I was studying science, all the time I was asking questions, and I began doing experiments as an undergraduate. And then I went on and did a PhD on parapsychology, and I did lots and lots of experiments. And early on, one of my experiments worked really well, and I got significant results. And then I discovered what was wrong with the statistics I'd used. One of the assumptions for that statistical test I'd violated, and I had to do it again in a different way, and then it was just chance. And after that, all of the experiments I ever did, the results were not significant. They were just what you'd expect by chance if there's no ESP going on. I then moved on to experiments on tarot cards, and I discovered quite an interesting psychological things about that works. You need to be face-to-face or listening down the phone to the person to get tarot readings to work. It's a social process. It's not, the cards are just kind of a help. They're not, there's nothing magic about them. And so on, so on. I did lots and lots of experiments on out-of-the-body experiences. And gradually, I just became more and more skeptical, obviously. And then at some point, I just suddenly thought, my God, maybe it's all rubbish, the whole lot, and there's no such thing as the paranormal, which was pretty awful to have to face up to, because you can imagine me in my hippie clothes as a tarot reader, etc. My whole persona had become associated with all this stuff. But I concluded that there were no phenomena. And then I joined the skeptics organizations, and I was the only person for a very long time who's ever been, I think, on the boards of both PSYCOP, the American Skeptical Organization, and the Society for Psychical Research in London. And I was trying to get both of them to speak to each other, because they're both supposedly investigating the paranormal with an open mind, but actually, you know, one lot are saying it's definitely true and the other lot saying it's definitely rubbish. And that was pretty painful, and eventually I just decided I had to get right out of the whole field, because I kept getting sucked back in. Lots of telly, lots of radio, because there's an endless newspapers, endless desire for in people for all this to be true. So I got right out. So I cannot answer your question in any modern up-to-date terms, but I used to know Dean Radin very well. I investigated many of his experiments a long time ago. One example, he and I were both invited to speak at the Royal Institution in London and have a debate, and this was before email. I mean, I'm really going back a long time. And he sent me a preprint of a paper that they'd written, and it had this particular figure, a kind of histogram in it. And I looked at this and I tried to make sense of it, and I discovered that it just simply didn't add up. It couldn't be doing what he said it was doing. So I wrote him a letter and said, this doesn't add up, you know. And he wrote back another letter and said, oh, thank you for pointing out a mistake. Oh, yes, we've made a mistake. And completely changed it. Well, that did sort of knock my confidence a bit. Anyway, we had a good debate. I followed his work probably, you know, up until about 15 years ago. I gather he's done a lot more since and that he's claiming significant results, but I am not competent to judge on those, even if I was many, many years ago. The same would apply with Rupert Sheldrake. I was involved in one of his early experiments. I collected data for him for one of his experiments, which was on morphic resonance. Mm-hmm. And it was absolutely chaotic. And at the end of that, I mean, he did claim to have got evidence for morphic resonance, but I found various problems with his statistical methods, which I tried to sort out. And again, I have not been involved in his more recent work. I'm not up to date with all his remote staring or the dogs who know when their owners are coming home. You know, I've read a little bit of it, but I am no longer an expert on these things. So my overall impression now is that it's things are as they have always been. There are the vast majority of scientists who just dismiss it out of hand, but they don't know anything about it. And why should they? They've got other more interesting things that they want to get on with. Then there are some scientists who've studied it, like myself, who are skeptical for good reasons. And then on the other hand, there are people who are getting significant results, but there are always critics coming along and saying, well, you did this wrong, you did that wrong, and then they try and improve it. The methods in parapsychology are extremely sophisticated and tight. I mean, they've been forced by being criticized over more than 100 years now to really tighten up their methods, and they have done so, and still just occasionally get, you know, extraordinary results. I exposed one example of fraud, and I've discovered all sorts of mistakes elsewhere. And, you know, I just do not know what to make of these occasional, apparently stunning results. One thing I would say, though, is you're never going to get any proper science out of this until there is some theory and some specific predictions made, which these significant results back up. At the moment, it's just floundering about with these very occasional significant results. And no theoretical progress whatsoever. So I'm glad I'm out of it. You know, if somebody really finds something, I'll be back into parapsychology like a shot. But so far, they haven't.
Well, I don't mean to let you down, but I won't be wasting any of my time on it. But it's interesting to say. Can you just elaborate, if at all possible, I understand if you can't, but on the fraud that you exposed? That sounds very interesting.
Yes, it was back in 1980 when a man called Carl Sargent in Cambridge was doing Ganzfeld experiments. This is where the person who is meant to be receiving the telepathic impression has half ping pong balls put over their eyes, and a red light shone it, so they just get a kind of uniform field and white noise in their ears, relaxing, usually lying down or perhaps in a very comfy sort of dentist chair thing. So they're very comfortable, and they stay like that for about half an hour, and they just talk about the imagery that they have. Meanwhile, a sender somewhere else is sending a picture or watching a video or something like that. And then afterwards, the subject has to go through all the things that they said during that session and try and match it up with four or five different numbers, different times, it doesn't matter, a few possible pictures or videos or whatever it is. And the claim is that they do much better than chance in picking the right one because of the imagery that they had during the Ganzfeld. Now, Sargent was getting fantastic results, really fantastic results with Ganzfeld. And I, when I was doing my PhD, was not. I was getting chance results. So I went to Cambridge. I got a small grant, cover my train fare and so on, from the Society for Psychical Research. And I went to Cambridge to spend a month there and to learn from him how to get these results. And I saw the most fantastic, in the first couple of days, I saw the most fantastic hits happening. And I began to think, my God, maybe my skepticism is misplaced. I was already becoming pretty skeptical then. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Really, from what I've seen here, with the sophisticated methods he's using and the good control conditions and so on, there's only two possibilities. One, this is really ESP. Or two, this is fraud of some kind. And I therefore set some traps and measured certain things that would go wrong under various theories I had about how somebody involved might cheat. And lo and behold, I found the evidence that I had predicted. So it looked very much to me as though the results were fraudulent. In fact, in one particular trial, I'm very confident about that. Nevertheless, I must say, Sergeant then wrote back with a colleague of his and said that it was all skeptical fairy tales from Bristol and that I was completely wrong and that it was all just a series of small mistakes that they'd made and it wasn't, you know, anything sinister at all. Nevertheless, they had made mistakes and those results really could not be relied upon.
How were they cheating?
In one particular, it's very, very complicated. As is so often the case in ESP experiments, a lot hangs on the method of randomization. So if you have a sequence that somebody has to guess, you can't just invent it. It's got to be as random as you can get so that you won't get any patterns in the data. So in the case of this experiment, the randomization was done. There were four pictures to choose from, and the experimenter who was going to go away and be the sender had a pile of 20 envelopes, which was supposed to contain 5 A's, 5 B's, 5 C's, and 5 D's. And that little pile was kept in Sergeant's room on the desk for the person who was going to do the sending to come every time. Well, then you realize that if that's done, and they can shuffle the envelopes and only open one of them, take it away with them, open it. If it's B, then they take picture B. Now, you can see that after each trial, there are only 19 left. So you have to replace the one that's been taken away with another envelope. And that envelope has to have the same letter in it, otherwise the pack will get unbalanced. And so that means you've got to have some other envelopes ready, which you know what they are. So that gives the opportunity for the person who is sending to actually take an envelope, not from the pile at all, but from the drawers in which these spare ones were kept. So I hypothesized that one would disappear from the drawer before the trial rather than afterwards, which is what happened. And in fact, I found one in the dustbin that shouldn't have been there, suggesting that the person who was being the sender had actually taken a known one. Instead of taking one from the pile of 20, took one out the drawer, which they knew what it would be. Now, why would that help? That would help either if they knew what kind of imagery the person was going to have, or if at the time of the judging, when the subject's experimenter and the subject sit together with the four pictures and go through all the imagery and try and tie it up. And it so happened on one particular trial that Sergeant himself was both the one who did the randomization and he came in on the judging session, which he never should have done. And I have notes to the effect that the other person there said that he appeared to be encouraging the person to choose picture B, which was the one that had disappeared from the drawers. Now, I know that sounds incredibly complicated. It was incredibly complicated. I spent days there absolutely racking my brains about this, and it was absolutely horrible, horrible, horrible. He was a friend of mine. I admired him greatly for the work he was doing. I was really excited and thrilled to go to Cambridge and have the chance of perhaps learning to get real ESP results myself because I was beginning to lose faith. And what did I discover? Either fraud or really bad mistakes, because that pile of 20, when I opened the whole pile later, the whole pile of 20 was not five of each. It was actually biased, which is what you'd expect if somebody